In this paper, I consider the usefulness of the theoretical and practical foundations of collaboration as it's been activated in the work of the Narratives in Space and Time Society, a collaborative artist group which I'm a part. Narratives in Space and Time researches, organizes, presents, and documents public art walks drawing on history, collaborations with other artists, and the performance and documentation of storytelling within community. Yesterday I mentioned the abandoned base at Shannon Park, so these are a few images from one of our walks. As a member of this group and as a co-producer of co-creative digital material since the 1990s, I'm mindful of the complex nature of the concept and practices of collaboration. I'm also mindful of the significant shifts that the notion of collaboration has gone through in relation to walking as storytelling, as an artistic practice, since the early 1950s. Collaboration's most recent allies, we heard some of them yesterday, about some of them yesterday, emerged from a set of related concepts, such as co-creation spreadability by Henry Jenkins and others, narrowcast audiences, which I do want to spend some time on, producage, which came up yesterday, and creative citizenship, which is my own concept, of which more later. Moreover, and I think this is the connection to a lot of work in this room today, I'm also highly aware of the importance of paying attention to the stories that are told and those that are left untold at resonant sites of engagement such as that of the Halifax explosion, which will have its 100th anniversary in 2017. I'll tell you about that in a sec. So today what I'm aiming to do is to briefly explore three areas of interest in the call and response nature of performative art making and storytelling with audiences, among other areas of interest, I would say, walking and mapping as an artistic practice, collaborative and co-creative storytelling as a community practice, and debris fields as sites of storytelling, which has resonances with several other papers. This is Narratives in Space and Time. Based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, there are five core members. They include Brian Lilly, who's in the middle in orange, a professor at Dalhousie University's Faculty of Architecture and Planning, whose specialties include integrated design and community engagement. Renee Grzecki, who's on the right here, who's a design and material cultural historian, as well as a clinical teaching associate at Dalhousie University's School of Medicine. Bob Bean and Barbara Lounder, Bob's in the corner, Barbara's in here, that picture with me, both of whom are quite well-known artists, curators, and scholars at NASCAD University dealing in communication issues, and then there's me. All right. So this is Narratives in Space and Time on the interweb. We have a beautiful but only periodically updated website that documents our activities with images and pithy descriptions. We have a Facebook page, which is quite active, and an extremely erratic Twitter account. We've developed a blueprint for an app that can serve the needs of the kinds of public art walks that we conduct. And we have dozens of digital trails registered in our archives, showing pathways that we've walked over and over by ourselves during research walks or with others during public art walks. As a group, we aim to facilitate co-creation of content and meaning with other artists and members of the public while resisting scripting those collaborations. This has proven to be an incredibly successful approach and incredibly difficult as we've engaged well over 300 individuals as participants or presenters in the last 3 years on this project alone. A little bit about the Halifax explosion. For those who don't know about it, it took place at 9:04 a.m. on December 6, 1917, towards the end of the First World War. Halifax is a working military harbor and has been so for well over 300 years. It's a naturally deep harbor, and it's quite, the ocean is out this way, and there's a very, very deep basin out that way. This is called the Narrows here. It's a naturally deep harbor, but during the wars, the harbor was packed with ships, both World Wars. The harbor was packed with ships avoiding German U-boats and other dangers. Two of these boats collided one morning in the Narrows here. One of them packed to the gills with explosives, just as children were on their way to school. The explosion and tsunami that resulted killed almost 2,000 people outright and blinded hundreds, causing the Canadian National Institute for the Blind to set up a huge operation in the city just after its own founding, the CNIB's founding. It was initially set up in Toronto and then moved to Halifax. The north end of the city, here, burned all the way up the hill, even through the blizzard the next day. One of Canada's famous group of seven painters, Arthur Lismer, was late taking the train in from the suburbs to his position as head of the art college, same art college that I went to, which meant he lived to sketch the aftermath, and they're the most powerful, in some of the most powerful images of the aftermath. The only First Nations encampment within the city was destroyed, and survivors moved to a reserve over an hour away. It was just across where you see those blue lines converging. In the subsequent rebuilding of the area, the Mi'kmaq were not invited back, nor were African Nova Scotians, mostly descendants of black loyalists and escaped slaves. None of these individuals were given as much recompense per capita as the working and middle class white communities located further up the hill to restart their lives. These are old stories, but they're seldom told. What is well known is that the Halifax explosion was the largest human-made bomb explosion ever created at that time, and its impact was studied for the development of the atomic bomb in the Second World War. The violence involved, the trauma, and the absence of people, just want to give you a look at this, the absence of people and their stories reverberates today with a massive shed, just you can see it there, just completed for a $30 billion contract for warship building that Nova Scotia won in competition with BC a few years ago. The shed is built virtually on the site of the explosion itself and blocks most of the harbor views that the aging public housing just above it used to call their own. It's the context. This is an area of trespass. You're not allowed on to be on this side. I'm going to leave the video to the end. If we have time, we'll watch it. But there's one of the key elements in that is this image of fire, and it recurs in all of our work. I also want to draw attention while we think about this to the roots of the narratives in space and time artistic practice in psychogeography, in particular the psychogeographic work of Debord in the 1950s, including the co-creative practices of the Derive or the Drift, and in artist-led events deriving from the Fluxus and Dada movements of the 1960s. Many of us involved at Narratives in Space and Time trained, and many of us have taught at NASCAD, reflecting also the tentacles, I'd say, of the conceptual art movement of the 1970s, where NASCAD excelled for a time. Consequently, as a group, we respond easily to the giving and taking of instructions in pursuit of quests and storytelling grounded in the spaces we occupy. Karen O'Rourke talks about, quote, artists as cartographers, end quote, to suggest that the way in which we could see the world is different from how we currently live in it. She notes, quote, cognitive mapping refers to the process of structuring and storing spatial information. We visualize our physical environment in terms of shapes and relationships, thus reducing cognitive load and enhancing learning, end quote. This allows artists, for example, to ask audiences to walk through one city using a map from another, just to see what that reveals. It also enables some great memory tricks. If you conceive of a complex idea as a series of rooms through which you move to arrive at a conclusion, then you can more easily remember the sequence of the arguments. The notion of navigating boundaries and territories is another way to think about this. Consider the artist projects that you know that involve labyrinths, mirrors, and tracking or wayfinding as crucial ways to generate alternative maps of the world. Janet Cardiff sends you on narrative adventures by giving you instructions and sometimes images to work with. Esther Pollock bends the documentary format to provide cameras to participants in milk production to document how Latvian milk travels from the cow to many homes elsewhere. Open source mapping, think of violent crime tracking or open street map in various cities, or Toronto's Murmur Project collects and shares oral histories. These were all originally artist storytelling projects meant to be shared. And this is the point I want to make about them, but they're only sustainable in the long run through voluntary participation or by using data in ways it wasn't first intended to be used. Consider the importance of power relations in all these negotiations. Look at this set of three, there's many more, alternative maps of the world and the author's reliance on understanding connectivity and convergence to demonstrate power relations. It's in the embedded power that projects that are involved in those kinds of relations that projects such as Narratives in Space and Time's debris field seeks to unpack in ways that make sense to the people living on the ground. This work makes me think about co-creation and convergence culture, which emerges in the late 1990s in conjunction with the financialization of the language of creativity. So for example, innovation, creative class, creative economy starts to ascend through discussions about creativity and culture. The enthusiastic uptake about the potential of the internet and mobile media to encourage the practice of democratic or interactive participation has been studied only obliquely in relation to public art practice, though much more widely in respect of industrial media production. The optimism practiced in the media industry, however, has become considerably tempered and nuanced since 2008, 2010, through those economic challenging times. The now sprawling domain of scholarly inquiry explicitly connecting the arts and humanities to technology, of course, contributed to the development of the digital humanities throughout the 2000s. The digital humanities themselves articulate foundational concerns with citizen engagement in social relations, for example, through the Digital Humanities Manifesto, and that's what I want to pick up on, that kind of intent. Narrowcast audiences. Hay and Coldry suggest that narrowcast audiences online are co-creative participants in interactivity and civic engagement, but interestingly to me, and ought to be to you, they omit mention of the work of the artist or creative producer as a contributor to this process. From my view, the more complex potential of the internet and mobile media is in a fluid combination of collective action archiving, aesthetic experimentation, and yes, some business ventures and infrastructures that involve audiences. This potential is made more obvious through the explosion and then the demise of websites, search engines, social media platforms, and dot-com businesses, which have been documented extensively, including my own work on CBC's experimental forays into digital media in the late 1990s, CBC, the public broadcaster in Canada. Co-creation emerged from and was reshaped by convergence culture in the 2000s. I'm going to leave aside the problematic of saying emerged from, but I recognize it. For artistic practice, this can include specific interventions by fans or by aspirational artists, we heard some about this yesterday, or groups of creative workers that include traditional producers who influence the interpretation of cultural content, remix it, comment on it, or otherwise reshape iterations of the programming or content in question. It also includes involvement and response of programmers, curators, media, and narrowcast audiences. Theoretical work by Axel Bruns in relation to convergence culture helpfully grapples with understanding audiences as producers in his term, opening the door to extending the notion of narrowcast audiences to becoming producers themselves, if only momentarily, as suggested in this image of Narratives in Space and Time audiences and their many, many smartphones documenting events they shared with us and with others. Bruns proposes the concepts of produsage and produceurs to bridge emerging relationships between certain narrowcast audiences and media producers during the 2000s. This has a place in media production studies. Producers are the aspirational, though still amateur, stage of Vicky Mayer's soft pornography videographers before they're commissioned as professional producers to provide piecemeal programming. Slightly more cynically, John Caldwell proposes understanding this relationship as a fully professionalized environment that enables increasing levels of increasingly precarious levels of worker-generated content. His analysis also points to the precarity of Brunn's producers, so the people in the previous slide have a very precarious relationship to professional documentation. These notions begin to explain how relations between artists, producer directors, and citizens slash collaborators slash consumers overlap and diverge from one another in terms of production practices as well as potential cultural expressions. The produsage relationship remains a fairly binary one between producers and users. It does not necessarily delineate a new distinctive role in the creative domain, though it aspires to provide a position of agency for the audience-based co-creators involved. And although it addresses a relationship between professional producer and a narrow band of narrow cast users, it cannot explicitly address the ongoing dialogic relationship. This is one of the things that I think was interesting about what JR said this morning, between artists, artistic creators as creators and as subjects, broadcasters, funders, policymakers, and narrowcast viewers beyond an immediate fan base. For that, I just want to turn for a moment to the concept of creative citizenship as I've developed it in my research, and think for a moment about the implications of debris, virtual, ephemeral, or physical. In creative citizenship, the artist or creative worker in a variety of roles is central. The collaborative nature of work involved is based on fluidly networked relationships among artists, creative producers, technical crew, programmers, in the case of media, broadcasters and distributors, and specific narrowcast audiences, including curators and influencers in the cultural community. Creative citizenship considers the potentially generative nature of artists' work as the most passionate and informed of narrowcast audiences, as well as through the production of creative experiments and objects themselves. This enables the incorporation of an increasingly complex and crucial understanding of co-creation from the professional end of the spectrum. This is an element of production that briefly raised its head in the late 1990s in television, in a multi-platform environment, and now strives to emerge again. That brings us back to narratives in space and time society and a consideration of debris. A suite of public art walks comprises the group's current overarching project, Walking the Debris Field, Public Geographies of the Halifax Explosion. The project is creating content for two exhibitions and an array of walking-based activities for the explosion's centenary in 2017, the same year as Canada's sesquicentennial. The focus for each Narratives in Space and Time event emerges from reflective discussions and explicit desires to engage audiences in narratives of the explosion, including how it has shaped the city, region, the country, and distinctly late 20th, and early 21st century preoccupations with the mediatization of conflict, trauma, and recovery that still reverberate today. In other words, by considering the debris of such events, we can learn something. Perhaps our most popular or intense engagements revolve around the expert reproductions of buildings that burned down during the explosion and our burning of those models. The act of destruction, preceded by explanations of historical trade routes, working conditions, and comparisons to those sites and the people who live there in the present day, are evocative and powerful stimulants to stories shared about similar circumstances. What we call giveaways, like these replica mortuary bags from our April walk, or the commemorative sculpture designed and built by a dozen architecture students in the summer of 2014, are tangible reminders for walk participants to continue to give consideration to the narratives of the city and how we interact on a daily basis. A community is created and sustained through engaging and shared public art experiences. The primarily content-sharing, genre-expanding, and narrowcast audience projects with which we're involved is reflected in, and I hope this has come across despite the tidy appearance of this PowerPoint, I hope it reflects the messy and kind of conflicted but effective space-making efforts that we undertake as a team of creative people with the help of several collaborators. An increasing number of narrowcast audiences. Our last walk had 100 people, and it was hard to communicate with everybody. And the disruption of civic expectations around a historical anniversary and its interpretations. The work of Narratives in Space and Time and several public art walks includes intense attention paid. I like this idea of the intensity of clusters. Stories shared and plenty of media uploaded to social media platforms. But it's in crowding together, physically crowding together, mobilizing in neighborhoods, listening, recording, editing, and sharing that our narrowcast participant groups really move towards produsage with us, including acts of engagement with historical influences on the present day. And we'll look forward to more. Thank you.